Next up is Inside Finance. Inside Finance is a special feature of this program every week where we discuss in depth the financial and economic challenges of our time and explore possible solutions. Here is your host this week, Stanford Simon.
Pleasant good day to Grenada, Caracou, Pity Martini, the rest of the Eastern Caribbean, wherever you are. I am Pastor Stanford Simon. Again, it's always a joy to be with you. This is Inside Finance. And as usual, I have someone here, no stranger to us. I am in Jamaica to the CDB governor's meeting here. And sitting before me, I have no other but the governor of the Eastern Caribbean Central Bank, Mr. Timothy Antoine. And you could hear the excitement in my voice. I guess many of you wondering, what in the world are we going to talk about? A whole lot of stuff. Hopefully we'll get through some of that. Some of the questions I'll ask him, I'm sure many of you want to ask him yourself. Governor, welcome to Inside Finance. You no stranger.
Thank you very much, Pastor Simon. And let me say good day to all of our listeners, home and abroad. It's good to be back on Inside Finance. I've actually missed you and the program.
No, I mean, it is so good when you reflect. We started it, and you've been one of every month, you pretty much were on the program, and not having you, it's strange. But it's good to have you now.
Well, it's good to be back. But I'm also pleased that the program is continuing, has continued with my colleagues from the Ministry of Finance. Because, of course, we believe in the mandate. So it's just great to be back. Good to see you as well.
Well, good to see you too. No, so tell us, how have you been doing and how are your family adjusting to St. Kitts? It's a new territory.
It is. We're adjusting well, so thanks for asking. My family and I, we're doing very well. So everybody moved, I mean, with me when I moved to assume office. And so far, they've settled in very well. They've been great.
School?
My daughters are in school. In fact, they started school the same day I started the job.
Wow.
The same day I assumed office. So there was very little time in between. We didn't want them to stay out of school very long. And I must say they've adjusted well. They've been to school. They've already sat exams. Because they had exams before Easter. Right. And of course, they'll be writing final exams again for this particular school year very soon. So they're settling very well, actually. You know, children seem to make the adjustment sometimes even faster and better than adults. But certainly my girls are doing well. My wife is great. She's been helping and settle us all in. And I want to thank her for that.
Okay. So how have you been settling to your new job? I mean, that is the big one.
Very good. Mm-hmm. Very, very good. I really have focused on engaging the team at the bank. And after it's been 3.5 months, just over 100 days, I have settled in very well.
Let me just ask this somewhat. How have you, I mean, to go into such a job is a completely different mindset and mind change from being in the ministry. What was that like for you?
Not as difficult as some might think. I think, you know, I've had good preparation. Meaning that I'm familiar with the central bank, familiar with many of the senior management at the central bank, and of course familiar with the Monetary Council and the board. In the case of the board, I served on the board for over a decade. So while it is a big adjustment in the sense that it's a different role, the truth is that many of the persons and procedures are familiar. Having said that, it is still very different, okay? It's one thing being on the board, is another thing being the governor and chairman of the board. And when you see the bank from the inside, it's a different view. But I think the fact that I come from outside, but have some familiarity with the institution, have stood me in very good stead in making the adjustment and settling quickly. And, you know, my team, in fact, have remarked on how easily they found my settling in. Now, I want to be clear, I'm learning a lot of things on the job, because as I said, when you're in the job, it's different from when you on the board or you're looking in, looking in from outside. But certainly, I've been able to settle in pretty quickly, hit the ground running. And I think that was probably one of the things the council considered when they made its final decision, who could really hit the ground running quickly. And I've done that, you know. So that's been good. If you want to know what I've been doing, I can share a little bit about that.
Well, I want to know that. I'm going to hold on because I want to leave that for the end. Now, how were your priorities for the first 100 days in office? Because you get into office, I guess you're new man on the ground. There are people to adjust, the meetings to have. Mm-hmm. You look at what you see and trying to assess what you see and how are you going to make things work and your new vision, I guess, mm-hmm. of the future of the central bank.
Right. So first of all, I spent the first 2 months, 2.5 months, casting a vision for the bank. In fact, from the very first day I assumed office, I met the entire staff, the entire team, and actually cast a vision for where I'd like to see the bank go for the next 5 years and beyond. And that's very important. And having done that, then begin to set some strategic directions. And I call it a new vision for a new era, because there are things we're going to do differently. There are things we have to do better. And I felt from the outset that I needed to sort of set those, give clarity to direction and vision. So I did that. And interestingly, I mean, 2 weeks after I assumed office, I had a meeting of the Monetary Council. Again, that went very well, considering it was, 2 weeks after I joined. But what I was able to achieve in that meeting was an endorsement of the vision by the Monetary Council, which is very important, so that it's no longer my vision, it is our vision, because it's now endorsed and shared by the council and by the staff of the bank. And having done that, we've begun to prepare a strategic plan, because we have to move from vision to venture.
Right.
We have to make the vision a reality. Mm-hmm. And to do that, we basically are working on a strategic plan. In fact, we have a first draft already, which we're currently discussing internally. But I also said something that was quite important, and that is internal listening. When I assumed, I said to my colleagues, we will be a listening bank. We will be a listening bank, and listening would start with me as governor. And I've kept my word on that. I've engaged the bank from top to bottom, all across the bank, one-on-one conversation, focus groups, departments, in various ways to hear from them. So it's me sharing with them some of my ideas, my vision for the bank, but also them, I'm hearing from them about their issues, their concerns, their aspirations, their ideas. And it's work. I kept saying to them, one of the things that I have to do is to look for the energy. Where's the energy in this bank? Where's the energy in this institution? Because we have to tap energy. When you want to implement something, you have right. to have energy to do it. You can say, you can paint a nice vision, but if there's no energy, it's not going to happen. So where is the energy coming from? And I know from experience, energy is not simply at the level of the senior management of the bank. It's all over the bank, sometimes from the people who are perhaps even at the junior ranks, in the junior ranks. So I kept looking for energy, looking for passion, and also what I call plugging or fixing energy leaks. So wherever in the organization, energy leaks. So everybody knows what that means in the bank. Wherever there were issues, whether there are protocols that were not working well for the bank and sapping energy, dissipating energy, I sought to fix those. So in the very first 6 weeks, we had adjusted a number of policies in the bank internally, quietly, that made everybody happier.
Right.
And in a sense, not in a sense, in a real way, raise the energy level of the bank. Because you need energy to implement vision. Exactly, yes. Exactly. But that came from listening. Mm-hmm. You see, so after setting the vision, then you have to listen, and then you clarify and you refine the vision, and then you work towards a strategic plan. So I did that. In fact, every Friday, once I'm in St. Kitts, I meet with a team over lunch. From every department. So that's...
So department by department?
For every Friday, I'm meeting with one person from each department.
One
so there
person.
Are 13 people wow. who meet with me. It's a one-on-one. There are no managers in the room. It's just my colleagues and myself. Wow. And we meet over lunch. Sometimes it's 2 hours, sometimes it's 3 hours, and we have a full discussion on anything and everything that they want to talk about, you know, related to the bank, how it's working, what's not working, what their concerns are, what their needs are, what their aspirations are. That has gone extremely well. Because what it has done is to give voice to a lot of our staff, especially the more junior staff, about things they'd like to see better, things they feel we could do to improve the bank, ideas they have for the bank. And that's been great. I've learned a lot. And also it gives me an opportunity to share with them my perspective. So they're getting to understand their governor, and I'm getting to understand my team. So it's actually a mutual benefit, and we do it over a meal. And there's no rush, because I see it as part of what I do.
Right.
So I'm not rushing off to another meeting. I give them the time, I give them the space, and they love it. In fact, the only concern is when I'm not in St. Kitts, because that means I'm not meeting somebody. And my commitment I gave from day one is I will meet with every member of a staff of the bank in overtime, using that approach, in addition to the departmental meetings, in addition to the one-on-ones and the various ways I meet the staff in the official business of the bank. So I now know almost everybody by first name.
Wow.
And that is, of course, because I've invested in listening, meeting people, getting to know them. And we have some great people at the Central Bank.
Yeah. How many staff you have at the bank?
Just over 200.
That's quite a lot of staff.
Yeah, just over 200.
And to know each of them by name, that's quite a challenge. Yeah.
Well, it's challenging, but it's not that difficult if you're meeting and engaging them regularly.
Well, true.
After a while, you get to know them pretty quickly. You get to know them. And I'm doing that.
Now, I understand you have taken the star motto by off to the ECCB. Tell us about that. I mean, it has been, little words creep out of the Central Bank, and the talk is that you have taken some things there.
Well, I have. As you recall, STAR was coined in Grenada, Juno Adjustment Program. It came to me while I was having my personal devotions one morning, and I shared it with the management team of the Ministry of Finance. They loved it. We improved it, and we've used it. So I took it to the Central Bank with a tweak. So everything else is the same except for the S. The S means service excellence. What I basically said to our team is that, listen, we're public servants. We're here to serve. We work for the people of the region. We're not here to big up ourselves. We're not here simply for a paycheck. We are here to serve. And because we're public servants, we must delight in serving, which means you got to listen, and we must be accountable for what we do. So that resonated very deeply within the bank and outside the bank, because I met people in the national community, you know, prominent leaders in St. Kitts and Nevis, other places, who heard and were really enthused by the message of service, and that we are in fact public servants, which is what we are.
Mm.
So, and I am the chief public servant in the bank. It's that simple. So service excellence, teamwork, accountability, results.
Wow.
All right? So that's our mantra. That's our core values.
Mantra, yeah.
That's what we rally around as a bank. That's how I'm changing the culture of the bank. And you have to change culture over time. So any computer that you put on in the bank right now, STAR comes up. And it's a daily reminder to everyone in the bank of our core values, the changing of our culture, and how we want to do our business, how we want to proceed.
Mm-hmm. Let me just remind our listeners, I'm speaking to Governor Mr. Timothy Antoine, who is the Governor of the Eastern Caribbean Central Bank. Governor, how strong is the Eastern Caribbean dollar?
Good question. Very strong.
Very strong.
Very strong.
Explain that to us.
So at this moment, our EC dollar is, the backing of our EC dollar is about 98%. What does that mean? Simply put, for every $1 in circulation, we have 98 cents in foreign reserves. So that's almost 100% backing.
Wow.
For every $1, we have foreign reserves, US dollars, euros, Canadian dollars, whatever currency we use, mainly US dollars, of course.
Mm.
But for every $1 in circulation, we have 98 cents in foreign reserves. So that's very strong. What does the law require? The law requires us to have the EC dollar back by 60%, which means for every $1, we should have 60 cents in foreign reserves. what do we have at the moment? 98 cents in foreign reserve.
That's so extremely strong.
So it's very strong. It's very strong. And notwithstanding the ups and downs of, you know, recent economic performance, we've been able to maintain a strong EC dollar. And that is extremely important because the EC dollar continues to serve us very, very well in the Eastern Caribbean. I don't think people understand, but the fact that we've had that stability since 1976, that's 40 years.
Since 1976, the EC dollar been pegged
to the US dollar, 1 to 2.7 since 1976. That's $40.
2.7.
One US dollar is equal to 2.7 EC.
And 40 years.
And that's been so for 40
years. We haven't shifted.
Yes, that's correct. You look around the Caribbean, and most of the other countries have had wild fluctuations over the time. We've been very, very stable. And that's a credit to us and to our leaders and to our people that we've been able to work together in a monetary union to be able to have that stability. And there are benefits. So one of the things it does, it gives confidence. People know that there's stability. So you minimize the exchange rate risk, currency fluctuation that you see in some of the other Caribbean countries or many, many, many countries around the world. It also helps to attract foreign direct investment because investors know the currency is stable. So they're not hedging bets. They know that they not only is it stable, but they can convert freely, meaning they can get US dollars quite easily. In many countries you go, you have to, including the Caribbean, you have to apply to get foreign exchange. You're traveling and you need to use your credit card, you have to apply. You want some cash to go with, you have to go to the central bank or you have to go to the bank and so on. And you have to make application and hope you can get, and they may tell you, well, you could only get $300 or $1,000 or whatever, US. We have no such issues. It's freely convertible. Once you have EC dollars, you can basically get US.
Walk into a bank.
Yeah, walk into a bank, a hotel, or whatever, and you can. It's freely convertible. And the reason why that is so is because of the backing. Because people know it's so strong, it's so fully backed that you can freely convert into EC or right. US. That's a wonderful thing. It's a major benefit. So it attracts foreign direct investment. It also means that we have, relatively speaking, low inflation because our inflation is pretty much tied to what is happening in the U.S. because we are tied to the U.S., among many other benefits. So the EC dollar is strong, and we want to continue to keep it strong. And, of course, there are things we must do together, governments, countries, banks, citizens, the central bank, to make sure that together we keep our EC dollar strong. And that is something that we're doing. So for example, one of the things that we've just launched in my first 100 days is an ECCB podcast called ECCB Connects.
Yeah, I saw that. Very interesting.
Right, and thank you.
Very, very interesting.
We said we were going to do it. On day one, I promised that we would do it, and we launched it in April. And every week, we feature some aspect of the bank's operations, the bank's work. But what we're doing is that we're giving people an inside track. I made the point very early that a lot of people know about the ECCB, but do not know how the ECCB functions, what it does, why it does it, how it serves. I want to change that. I want to open up the bank. I want to make the bank more transparent. And more transparent does not mean just publishing financial statements, which we do. More transparent means making people better understand what we do by sharing, explaining, opening up ourselves,
right,
subjecting ourselves to questioning so that people understand the operations of the bank. I am fully committed to that.
Which I find to be very interesting. When I listen to the podcast, I get to understand the numbers on the dollar, each thing, what the security features of the dollar. I didn't really know a lot of it.
Right, because it's so important to us, we need to understand it.
Yes.
We need to understand it, we need to embrace it, and we need to preserve it. And that is really a commitment I make to the people of this region, that we will continue to explain ourselves, to open up the bank, to make ourselves more accessible, more understandable. So the podcast is simply one way we do that. But there are other things we're doing as well. I mean, we're in the social media space. In fact, in my very first week, we got onto YouTube. So if you want to get to ECCB Connects, by the way, the simplest way is to go to YouTube and just hit ECCB Connects. That's and all the programs come up. Every week, every Wednesday, you get a program. They're not too long, so it's good length, we think.
It's just about 15 minutes.
So it holds people's attention. But what I do want to encourage is that people listen to the programs and share it with their friends, and also give us feedback on what they like, what they may not like, and what they'd like to see us focus on or feature. And if there's any aspect of the bank operations that we can help better explain for students, for teachers, for academics, for policymakers, for citizens, because we are citizens first and foremost, we'd love to do that. That's part of our responsibility as far as I'm concerned. So ECCB Connects is one way of reaching out. Mm-hmm. Social media is another way. We are also, we're redeveloping our website. So we've launched an RFP for our website. I know we've got some responses. Our deadline was May 15th. And I believe we got 14 submissions. And we were able to attract some very competent firms. And God willing, we will have a full, modern, very accessible and very attractive website. That's something I believe is extremely important for us to, as a communication tool, but it's also our image and reputation, and it's the ability of people to go and find things quickly. The fact of the matter
is, access to information.
Yeah. I mean, I went in there, looked at the site, and said to our guys, I said, you know, there's some things that need a facelift, others a overhaul, and some things a funeral. And our website needs a funeral. Okay, guys, we're going to change this website. Okay? Everybody agreed? Because it's cluttered. And I apologize for that, but we're going to fix that. So over the next few months, we're going to develop a first-class website where people can find things quickly, people can maybe even buy things. We it's going to be very, very modern. And we're committed to that. So that is another way of reaching out and engaging our public, our people. Another thing we're doing, in fact, I've just started doing, so after spending the first period on listening and internal listening and engaging the staff and getting to know the staff and them getting to know me a bit, I've now pivoted to some external listening where I've started a country outreach. So I'm going through all of the countries of the ECCU, and when I visit each country with a small team, I meet the cabinet, the leader of the opposition, the bankers association, the chamber, which is the private sector, social partners, including the labor unions and the churches, and the media. And also I'm trying to meet youth. And if I don't get to do it in the first round, certainly the second round, I'm going to meet youth, because I feel it's very important to meet youth. In fact, last Friday I met the youth parliament in St. Kitts and Nevis. So far I've covered St. Kitts and Nevis, and I've covered Antigua and Barbuda. I'm going to Montserrat next, and then I'm going to come to everybody, including Grenada.
Wow, we look forward to your visit.
Yes. So that's in the works. We finalizing schedule with all of the countries now, and I'm looking forward. And for me, it's we're going to share a bit of what we're doing, but it's also an opportunity to listen and hear what the citizens of our region are concerned about, what they feel we can do better, what they feel we can help with. And we want to be helpful in that regard.
Let me remind our listeners, I'm speaking to Mr. Timothy Antoine, who is governor of the Eastern Caribbean Central Bank. We're here in Jamaica to a meeting to the
Meeting of the Caribbean Development Bank.
Meeting of the Caribbean Development Bank, a visit for a minute. And you have been part of that for quite a while too.
Indeed. I served on the board of the Caribbean Development Bank, and also as an alternate governor for several years. So I'm very familiar with the bank, the management and the team at the bank. So it's a very familiar setting for me.
Yeah, I see you. You're pretty much, everybody seems to know you, and you seem to know everybody.
We have a lot of friends around the region. I think there's mutual respect with many of my colleagues. Many of them are also very happy for me in my new role, and have pledged their support. Mm. So it's my way of reconnecting with them, continuing to support CDB as best as I could, but also looking for ways to partner with CDB. And we're doing that in a number of ways.
Okay. And Governor, the question I guess a lot of people are asking, including a lot of Grenadians, when would we see a signature on the dollar?
Yes, I get asked that very often these days. It's going to be a little while still. And here's why. The central bank maintains a stock of currency so that, you know, we don't run out of currency. We have to take the old ones and replace them with new ones and so on. And just before I came, they ordered a new set. Typically, they order for 3 years. So that they order in advance and they make sure that they're well stocked. So it's whenever we do new coins and currency, well, new notes, sorry, the signature of the new governor.
So at least it's 3 years before we see
that. It'll be a while. So I want to manage expectations. It's going to take a little while. It's going to happen, but it's going to take a little while.
What is the ECCB doing on the issue of correspondent banks? Because I guess for us to understand where we are on that and the issues relating to correspondent banks.
Right. So the issue of correspondent bank relations, otherwise known as de-risking, is a very serious concern for the Caribbean, not just the ECC, for CARICOM. It is well known that several of our countries or banks in our countries have been advised that their correspondent bank relations may be terminated. Couple cases, they have been terminated.
Why?
The main concern on the surface is money laundering and terrorist financing. Right? Money laundering and terrorist financing. The banks are concerned that they can inadvertently facilitate the laundering of money. Drug traffickers, drug dealers, what have you, terrorist financing, terrorists. And of course, they don't want to do that. Now, the real rub is that if that were to happen, the banks in the U.S., which are our correspondent banks, can be fined very heavily by the U.S. regulators. You're talking million-dollar fines. So because of the fear of these hefty fines, they are very, very cautious. Now, just to explain for people, I mean, correspondent banks, if you want to do a wire transfer, you want to send money to your child who's studying in school in the U.S., you have to do a wire. You need a correspondent bank. Your bank in Grenada needs a bank in New York,
right,
or in the U.S., mm-hmm, wherever it is in the U.S., to be able to do an intermediary function. That's a correspondent bank. If your family is in the U.S. or the U.K. or Canada and wishes to send money to you, a remittance, they need to do a wire, or they need to use a money transfer agency. Okay? That's another way. If tourists are paying, a tourist wants to come for a vacation, they have to pay the hotel, they want to do it, they have to use the services, or guests or hotels, business people have to settle business. So it's trade. It's trade, it's tourism, it's remittances, it's life, it's economic activity. So it's critical for us to be able to maintain these correspondent banks. And that's a real concern that we have at the moment. What I also discovered, because I was in Washington a few weeks ago, is that some of the heads of banks in the U.S. are concerned that they could be held personally liable for any breaches, in other words, any money laundering or terrorist financing that happened through their institution. And by personally liable, I mean not fined, they could go to jail.
Wow.
So that fear is also playing into the situation. So what are we doing about the situation? We're taking it very seriously at the highest levels of government, at the central banks, and of course the banks themselves. We've given initial advice from our central bank to our governments is as follows. One, we need to have a strong advocacy campaign using political and diplomatic channels to explain how this issue is hurting us and why it is that we need to make sure that there's full cognizance of the impact on the region. Because in some cases, we believe that the decisions are arbitrary, they are without basis, but they're being done out of fear, without understanding the implications for the Caribbean. All right, so we need to make sure we get that message across. Who are we talking to? We're talking to the U.S. government. So I know at the level of CARICOM heads, they've engaged President Obama. Certainly, they've engaged the U.S. Treasury. At my level, I'm talking to the U.S. Treasury, which is the Ministry of Finance in the U.S. Obviously, State Department, which is the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. We're talking with regulators, which are involved, and we're also speaking with some of the corresponding banks themselves. So we are engaging them to better understand their concerns and try to address those concerns. And we're making the point, we're not asking for the lowering of standards with AML and CFT's concern, anti-money laundering and combating financing of terrorism. What we're asking for is for clarity, for consistency, and for reasonableness. In other words, look at what we have done. The reality is that many of our countries have taken significant steps, made major strides to combat money laundering, anti-money laundering, and terrorism. They've done a lot, and they obviously have to continue to do quite a bit. It's not easy. It's not cheap. But if you talk to the banks,
it's very expensive.
It is. You have to put in all of these protocols. You have to hire staff. So you have compliance people who have to be hired to do these things. I was speaking to a senior regional banker last night, and in fact, he was making the point that in the last couple of years, they've had to hire just over 100 people across their bank. It's a big bank, to be able to deal with these compliance issues and their cost, because obviously you have to pay for staff, which is part of the reason why you're also seeing fees, which is a very vexing issue in the region, this proliferation of fees.
Yeah, these fees are continuing to climb.
Yes, but they have to cover these additional compliance costs in the US, in the UK, and wherever else. So we've said advocacy is one. Secondly, we've asked all our banks to register on the SWIFT portal, because you have to know your customer's customer. When we started this thing with money laundering, anti-money laundering 10 years ago, 15 years ago, we talked KYC.
What is KYC?
Know your customer.
Okay.
So you have to know who you're doing business with. Mm-hmm. And you have to make sure they're not laundering money or funding terrorism. Right? Now they've taken it a step further, and it's KYCC. Know your customer's customer. So for example, say a bank is dealing with a credit union, and a credit union is dealing with a fisherman. The bank needs to know the fisherman.
Wow.
The customer of the bank is a credit union. The customer of the credit union is the fisherman. The bank needs to know the fisherman. It's know your customer's customer.
That's deep.
That's deep, because the concern is you may be facilitating certain illegal activities, money laundering, and terrorist financing. So it really puts a lot of onus on the banks or the financial institution, credit unions, for example, to know what your customers are doing, how they generate an income, and when they make deposits, where are those deposits coming from?
Mm-hmm.
All right. The reality is that most of the money laundering and terrorist financing that takes place doesn't take place in the Caribbean. It takes place in the large centers of the world. We know that. But like everything else, we have been held accountable.
Get caught in the net.
Yeah. And of course, we're paying a very heavy price for that issue. So we've advised advocacy, registering on the SWIFT portal, and so far I think 7 of our 13 national banks, indigenous banks, have done that. We expect them to all do that soon. The third area is we need to see and encourage further consolidation in the banking sector. Because what's happening is that because these costs are going up so dramatically, exponentially, it's putting a lot of pressure on the smaller banks who have to hire staff, who have to have all of these risk management protocols in place, and at a very challenging time. So it's almost impossible now, virtually impossible, for very small banks to survive in this economic environment where there's so much pressure from outside. So as a result of that, we're having to see, and we are seeing, and we will continue to see further consolidation coming together, because essentially these banks have to muscle up to be able to meet the challenge.
But then what about our national banks?
Right. So our national banks, they are the ones who are most affected by this issue of correspondent bank relations, not the international banks. They're not being affected directly. Except that compliance costs are going up across all the banks, because all the banks, national and international, have to respond to these international imperatives. But in the case of the national banks, they do not have a parent to run to.
Okay.
You see, whereas the international banks can run to their parents in Toronto or in Trinidad or wherever, the national banks have no parent to run to.
They're
on their own. And it's difficult for them, because they have to face the same cost. And the truth is, they don't have the same depositor base. They don't have the same resources, the same back office that the international banks have. I have been clear, as governor, I've made it clear that I support the role and the necessity for national banks. And by national banks, I mean indigenous banks. They have a role in our development. And I am not one who wants to only see international banks. But I'm also very clear that these national banks have to be strong enough to have the capital adequacy, to have the risk management framework, to have the appropriate technology to be able to not just survive, but be able to respond to threats and to be able to serve well and not be a risk, a threat to the financial system. Weak national banks are a threat to the financial system. They need to be strong. And part of how they become strong is they have to come together. They cannot make it on their own. It's as simple as that.
So it means looking at all the national banks across the OECS and saying somehow you find a way to create a synergy of coming together then.
There has to be a coming together. And it needs to be done urgently, and it also needs to be done thoughtfully. Because what you don't want is a situation where they are forced at the very last minute, because you're going to get less than optimal or less than ideal outcomes. The signs are on the wall, the writing is on the wall, the signs are clear. What you need is for them to look for ways to come together, to become bigger, to be able to compete. Because at the end of the day, if your costs keep going up, your market share is not growing, your profitability is falling, after a while, you're going to go under.
You're going to sink.
Yeah, because you can't maintain a capital adequacy. You can't expand the business because you don't have the financial muscle, the financial wherewithal to do that. That is going to affect you in a negative way. You're not going to survive. And so it's very important that they be proactive on this thing, because as much as I want to see the survival of national banking in the currency union, it cannot be at the risk of financial stability. It cannot be where we have weak national banks lurching from one crisis to the next. Because when that happens, it puts the deposit at risk. So, and we can't have that.
So simply put, you are saying to the national banks across the region, OECS, you need to find a way of coming together and need to be done sooner than later.
There is real urgency. And they know that. They know that. But I think, you know, we do not have a lot of time for people to come together. So strategic partnerships have to be found. And we started the process of consolidation. I mean, in Anguilla very recently, we had to resolve two troubled banks. So late April 22nd, we resolved two banks. So we now have one bank, National Bank in Anguilla, instead of two. In Antigua and Barbuda, we've also done that at least twice. So we now have a bigger bank coming out of four banks. We now have two or one, you know. So we're seeing a consolidation, but it needs to happen faster because the demands are mounting.
Are greater.
And daily, every day there's something new coming out. And every new development has cost implications. So it's very, very difficult. And that is partly why you're seeing these fees, which I mentioned a while ago. The other reason, very important reason, is because of the high level of non-performing loans. You see, there's a high level of non-performing loans, bad loans, in our banking system. Right now, it's around 17%.
Which is high.
The benchmark is 5%. So part of that is, I mean, simply put, if you have a bad loan, then it means that you're not getting the kind of income that you should be getting. Okay, so what the banks are doing is they're looking for other ways to generate income. And they're doing that through fees, to the annoyance of many customers.
Which we feel very, very cheated and unfair.
People feel very strongly about that. But the banks are looking for ways to recover, especially because of their declining profitability. It's a very challenging issue for the banks, because I also make the point, banks need to make money. You see, if a bank isn't making money, we have a problem. Mm-hmm. You see, a bank cannot lose money for a long time, because what do banks do? Banks take deposits, they make loans. They make their income from loans. If the loans are bad, then they're going to experience a decline in profitability, and they're going to put deposits at risk. And we don't want that. So it's very important. In fact, it's the sign of health that a bank is making money. Now, we could argue about how much is enough, but banks must make money. And because your deposits, my deposits, are involved. And if they don't make money, they're not going to be able to give us back our deposits. So it's very important that we have a very balanced discussion in the currency union about what banks, the obligation of banks to customers, And of course, it's also important that the banks are not excessive with the fees. So I challenge them to be transparent with their fees. We do question some of the fees, but the central bank itself does not have control over the fees.
The central bank don't have no control over the fees.
No. We can use what is called moral suasion. We can ask them to be reasonable, but the law does not give us the authority to regulate fees like how we regulate the savings rate, the interest rate. Okay. So that's something our public needs to understand. But we're very concerned, I mean, so is the Monetary Council, about the proliferation of fees and bank charges across the currency union. I'm explaining partly why it's being done. I'm not saying I agree with the fees, but I also understand the challenges that some of our banks are under. And the way to deal with that is partly to get bigger so that you have more economies of scale. Right, so that you can cover your overheads. It's easier to cover your overheads. The national banks in particular will find that they have to keep driving up these fees. Not just the national, all the banks, but the national ones are particularly
going to be under tremendous pressure
because they do not have a big parent to draw on.
So that leads me to this question. Will there be growth in the Eastern Caribbean currency union this year with all that's happening? With you have people cannot pay their loan, you have delinquencies up, bank fees are going up, you're looking at the job market across the region, you're looking at the growth of many of the countries across the region. There are a number of things happening. Will there be growth?
Yeah, there will be. Our economies are growing again, not as fast as we would like, but they are growing again. Certainly, we expect to have growth of probably around 2.5% as an average across the currency union. In some countries, including Grenada, St. Kitts and Nevis, Antigua and Barbuda, we'll have even higher levels
of growth.
Of growth, right? Because
it looked that good for.
Well, it's improving. I mean, we want to get to 5% and above. So, it's progress compared to a few years ago when we were in recession. But obviously, we need to see our economies grow faster. We need to see our employment situation continue to improve. Non-performing loans are actually falling. Okay, a year ago it was 18%. Right now it's 17%. We hope that will continue to go down, and it will. It will take some time, but it will. So the situation is improving, albeit slowly. But obviously, as a central bank, we want to see. It's very important for us, for financial stability, that we see the non-performing loan situation improve, which means to say non-performing loans must fall, right? We want to get to 5%, which is the international benchmark.
Mm. As we conclude, what would you say was your most challenging part of all of this in the last 3 months being at the ECCB as governor?
Challenging part. Well, every day is a challenge.
Most challenging.
I think it is just being able to engage the staff. Listening is work. So let's be clear on that. I'm committed to listening, but listening is work. Because you listen, as I tell people all the time, with your ears, with your eyes, with your head and with your heart. So the most enjoyable part of the job so far has been listening. It is also the most challenging part of the job. Mm. Because when I sit down with the team and I engage them fully, at the end of that exercise, I'm physically
drained.
It's emotional because you engage, you're fully engaged. A three-hour discussion with a wide-ranging discussion, I mean, you're fully, fully engaged. My mind is working, my hand is working, I'm fully, fully engaged. So it's been very productive, very, very productive. But I think it's also perhaps the most challenging part. Aside from that is the meetings. We have a lot of meetings in the bank. And so I'm looking at that. I'm looking at how we could streamline some of those meetings. I remember in my first couple of days, Governor, you have this meeting now. Governor, you have this meeting now. So I had to say to my administrative professional, my assistant, You know, I mean, I need to figure out where the bathrooms are around here, you know. I mean, I need a few days to get it. Well, I was kidding with her, of course, but the point was, I mean, you know, and of course, I wanted to meet the staff. I didn't know, I just wanted to be in meetings all day. So I've had to back off on some of these meetings and to kind of cut down some of the meetings because there are many of them, some of them are important. We are a bank where we have a lot of internal controls and we monitor things daily. Report on them daily and weekly and monthly and quarterly. So it's a very organized place. And so there are a lot of committees, but I think we have too many. So we started cutting down on a few. We started reducing the numbers, the frequency, because I also want to make sure that people have time on the job, meaning at the desk,
right,
managing departments, actually doing work, not just meeting. Although you do have to have accountability and monitoring, and that's part of how you what you do when you do these meetings. So that's probably the two areas that challenge. The listening, which I've enjoyed. So it's not a complaint. I actually enjoyed it, but it does take out of you because listening is hard work. And secondly, the meetings, managing the meetings internally. But that's something we're working on.
And what has been your most rewarding?
Just listening to our staff, especially our younger members, express themselves. Seeing them come alive, you know, I had people who've said to me openly and in one-on-one conversations that they really feel energized about working for the central bank. They like the vision. They want to be part of the vision and bringing it into reality. They've embraced me as their governor and want to work with me and want me to lead them. And for me, it's a joy to hear that, but more importantly, it's the opportunity to serve. The opportunity to serve. So with the men and women at the central bank and serving the people of our region. And every day I go to work, I feel that I'm serving. I'm helping. I'm addressing the issues. They're challenging issues, but I also feel that I can be part of the solution. So that is energizing for me, actually. I've thoroughly enjoyed my first 3.5 months in the job.
Well, I'll leave the final word to you.
The final word is that I just want to say to the people of Grenada, whom I love dearly, thank you very much for all of your prayers and support. I get messages sent all the time through my parents, through my family, through friends, colleagues, asking about my well-being and my family. I want to thank you for asking. I want to thank you for your prayers, your love and support, which I feel that's a big part of helping me to do this job. And I covet your prayers and your continued partnership. So thank you very much. And I look forward to seeing many of you soon when I visit Grenada.
Oh, by the way, St. George's Baptist Church, they missed you. They miss your preaching. They really miss you.
Well, I miss them too. It's funny, but I actually do miss sharing the word. I'm going to be doing some of that in St. Kitts. I've been asked already. And I'm just visiting churches, but I've been asked, a few people have asked. So eventually I'll be doing some of that. But I miss the good people at St. George's Baptist. I really do. I've always found them to be a very generous people, very warm. Whenever my wife, my family and I visited, we always felt that. So I do miss that. And of course, I miss my home church. So it's that's some of the sacrifices one makes. Yes. But I'm not complaining. I've also found a lot of support in St. Kitts. I visited a lot of churches so far, and everywhere we've gone, people have reached out to us, and they've been warm and supportive. So God be praised.
Thank you so much, Governor Mr. Timothy Antwine, Governor of the Eastern Caribbean Central Bank. I really enjoy having this discussion with you here on Inside Finance. We haven't spoken for a couple of months. We meet here in Jamaica, and that's where we're having this discussion. And I hope as we meet across the region, I'm sure we will be meeting again, we'll have this discussion just to keep us informed. And I appreciate you taking the time just to come and sit down and talk with us here. And we spoke for over 40 minutes. And you're a busy man, and I know you have a lot to do, but I very much, and I think the people of Grenada appreciate that you're spending this time to talk with us and just to let us know how you're doing, and we're very happy to hear that.
Thank you very much. Always my pleasure.
All right.
God bless.
All right, folks, you have been listening to the program there, Inside Finance. I am Stanford Simon, speaking there with the Governor of the Eastern Caribbean Central Bank, Mr. Timothy Antwine, who took up his position this year, doing extremely well. He's listening a lot. And his signature will take quite a while to get. We have a couple of years to wait, but we wait patiently to have that, and I know that we are. Have yourself a great week as you can just share together. Go to the website sgbcgrenada.com. This program will be uploaded there, and I'm looking forward in meeting you right back here on the station for another program of Inside Finance. Also go to the Ministry of Finance website. This program also will be uploaded there. Go to sgbcgrenada.com. Take care. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to another edition of Inside Finance, a program that explores the financial and economic challenges of our time. Join us next week for another edition.